Welcome back to the Cape Fear Rundown. This week, we have a conversation with Nikolai about the Leland property tax hike and some of his takeaways. And then Kelly joins us to talk about her conversation with the founder of Strong Towns. Stick around. Recently, Leland proposed a 70% property tax increase, which is pretty significant. Naturally, people were concerned and came out in force on March 21st to a town council meeting. Nikolai was there to cover the meeting and joins us now to talk about some takeaways he took from it. Welcome back to the Cape Fear Rundown. I'm here with Nikolai Mather.
Hi, Cammie.
Hi, Nikolai. Okay, we need to talk about Leland because there's a lot going on over there. Can you tell us about Leland? Bring us up to speed. What's going on?
Oh, man. There's a lot going on in Leland right now. And there was a lot going on in Leland last month. We had like a really huge public meeting where the town council discussed their proposed 70% property tax hike. It drew hundreds of people. I counted at least 300, though some outlets put the number closer to like 600.
Wow.
A lot of town council members that I spoke with said it was the most that they've ever seen at a public meeting.
Okay.
Most of the people who were there were angry, bewildered, scared, sad, you know, just upset about the tax hike. About the proposed tax hike. It was a lot of heckling. It was a lot of booing. It was standing room only in the town council meeting room. People were like leaning up against the walls, sitting on the floor, in the lobbies. I even saw a couple people who like grew faint from the heat in the crowd and had to get some medical attention from some of the security officers.
Wow.
It was tough. It was a very long meeting and it was a very, contentious one. So the town council eventually concluded it by moving to hold a workshop on April 9th. To tinker with the budget a little bit more. That meeting will also be open to the public, and it seems like many people who were there the first time will be showing up to watch it again. A big difference, though, is that this meeting will not have a public comment period.
Why?
That's what I was wondering, too. Like, I asked a town council member named Bill McHugh about it, and he told me that the reason why they're not having a public comment period is that this is solely a work session.
Okay.
They received like a ton of feedback during this last council session and also in the interim between the like that last one and this next one. Mm. And they want to devote this next session to just digesting and acting on that feedback. They're not voting to approve any budgets right now. That'll come later. But they're just trying to workshop things. They've tried to make it really clear in the meeting notices, too, that there won't be a public comment period. But I still think that there will be some people who show up thinking there will be one, or people who will try to speak out of turn anyways.
Okay, but is it a good idea to not have a public comment period?
I don't really know. I should make it clear, too. Like, I've been covering meetings like these for, like, 5 years.
Mm.
Not in Leland, necessarily, but I've worked in Charlotte covering, like, council meetings. I've worked in Athens, Georgia, covering council meetings. And then I go to a bunch of different council and commission meetings here at this job. So I've seen a lot of this kind of stuff. I've seen a lot of very angry, outraged people showing up en masse to council meetings. I think on the one hand, I understand that the purpose of this meeting is not to take suggestions from people. It's to work on the budget.
Okay.
But on the other hand, you got to keep crowd control in mind. I think it'll be really hard to get that work done if you don't give folks an outlet for their frustrations. Like this past meeting, they had folks sit through 2 hours of town council business before finally getting to the budget part of the discussion.
Mm.
And that just made people angrier because they had to wait a super long time to say their piece during the public comment period. It also made it really hard to discuss all other important business because everyone was heckling and booing and like were frustrated because they had to sit for so long. You know, I've also noticed that in the 5 years that I've been covering meetings like these, I've noticed that most people tend to leave once the public comment period is over. Once you give people like a set moment to express their opinions, it really, really helps with crowd control. Not saying that like, you know, like they want to hide anything from folks who show up. It's still going to be streamed online. People are still going to be present after the meeting most likely. But it would kind of probably alleviate things a little bit if they held a public comment meeting right off the jump and then like people would just naturally leave afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So still, McHugh said that they are keeping crowd control in mind. He told me that they're going to set up a lot more seats in the overflow areas in the lobby so people don't have to, like, stand or sit on the floor. He also said they're trying to resolve the audio issues which plagued this past meeting. It was so hard to hear what was going on. So, yeah, they are keeping crowd control in mind, but I am wondering if the lack of public comment period will cause more heckling like it did last time.
Okay, so what do we think is going to happen at this next meeting?
I think it probably depends on how many people show up to this meeting. Something that Nicholas Newell said, he's like a former town council candidate that I interviewed for one of my articles last week. Something he told me was that he was worried that the town would still issue a very high property tax increase. Maybe not 70%, but still high. Leland also proposed a 30% hike and a 50% hike prior to these meetings. And Newell wondered if the council was going to float 50% to appease residents, even though that's still kind of a hefty percentage. So I think only time will tell. I think that the meeting is definitely going to have some interesting and important discussions, maybe lend a little more rationale into the decisions that led to the proposal.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think only time will tell.
Now, for Leland residents who are currently angry and upset, I mean, this is a 70% property tax hike. Is there any words that you may have?
Oh, man. I totally understand where they're coming from with the frustrations. Like, a lot of people feel like they've been locked out of the political process or almost blindsided by this very extreme jump in property tax hikes. I think it's really awesome that so many people are politically active in Leland. It's really tough to be politically active, too. Like, you got to be educated and, like, not just educated by Facebook or Nextdoor. You got to be respectful, even when you're hopping mad. And you got to be organized. Like, you got to build a campaign that sustains rather than just kind of fizzles out of existence after a few weeks, you know? It makes me really happy to see so many people striving to do those three things, especially being respectful, even when it's on a topic as touchy as this. So, I don't know. Being politically active rules. I hope to see people of Leland organizing over things besides the property tax hike, you know? Being a part of your local community politically is super important. So keep doing that. Thumbs up.
Well, we have you to cover the news over there. So I'm sure it's great that people have the media covering these things. We appreciate your coverage. And thank you for being on the show with me this week.
Yeah, thank you. Bye, Cammy.
What makes a town strong? Is it the fact that it goes to the gym and lifts, or is it connectivity and fiscal responsibility? Kelly joins us now to tell us.
Welcome back to the Cape Fear Rundown. I'm here with Kelly Knoyer.
Hi, Camille.
Hi, Kelly.
How's it going?
It's good. I have you here to talk to us about strong towns. You spoke to someone from strong towns, but first of all, we need to explain what this actually is. What is it like? Towns that are beefy?
Towns that lift.
Okay, what is Strong Town?
So Strong Towns conceptually is an organization, it's a nonprofit that is interested in figuring out ways for municipalities, for communities to be financially strong and independent without hurting their bottom line.
Okay.
Basically, it comes down to both connectivity and issues around the tax base that can be built from different types of development. So they have done a lot of digging. One firm that they work with called Urban 3 is actually out of Asheville, North Carolina. And they have found that suburban styles of development are really tax takers more than tax givers. Like they take a lot more revenue than they give back in terms of their tax base. And basically the reason that's the case is that suburban housing developments are houses that are really far apart with a lot of space in between them, which means there's more infrastructure in between the actual houses. It's more pipes, it's more roads, it's more electrical wiring. Whereas if the houses are close together or if they're apartments or townhouses, they're close together. And so the amount of infrastructure to connect these things together on the same grid is less, which means that on a per capita basis, they are cheaper. And that means that the tax pays for itself. So that's kind of the economic driver behind strong towns. But overall, they're interested in talking about what makes a city a good place to live, what makes it a place that economically works. And that's kind of the concept. So I wanted to ask them about housing affordability.
So who did you talk to from strong towns?
I talked to the founder, Chuck Marone. Kind of like a star power moment for me because I'm a nerd and I've been following strong towns for like 6 years. And it was really interesting because he did not give me the answer I expected.
Okay, so what did you guys talk about? What was the answer that you were not expecting?
Okay, well, first, what would you expect him to say? If I framed it around the endowment, I said, hey, you're the founder of this organization. You care about fiscal responsibility. You care about how cities are built. How do you think our city, our community, should spend $50 million annually, potentially pie in the sky, from the endowment to deal with housing affordability, to deal with our lack of affordable housing? What do you think he would say?
Build more housing.
Right. But, like, what kind of housing?
Affordable housing.
And who's building it?
Oh, who is building it?
Normally developers, right?
Yeah.
You would think it would be apartments.
Yes.
That's not what he said.
So what did he say?
He said that we should be making it really easy to build accessory dwelling units.
ADUs, really?
ADUs. So granny flats, basement conversions into apartments. He basically said, think about it. There are tons of baby boomers. There are tons of elderly people who live in houses that had 5-6 bedrooms. They raised their families in them. Now it's maybe one or two people living in this big empty house. Mm-hmm. They can barely afford to maintain it. What if you just put an exterior door and a kitchenette in part of that house and made it so it was a secondary dwelling? Now they're getting rental income. And they are providing housing that didn't previously exist in their neighborhood to somebody who needs it. He said that this is a way of creating a new entry level of housing that makes it so that the floor for what's accessible is a lot lower. So right now, the floor of housing in our community is a single bedroom apartment. And those are going for like $1,200 on average right now.
Yeah, that's pretty expensive.
But if it were a 400 square foot ADU that somebody converted their basement into, maybe it would be 800, maybe it would be 700, especially if the market was saturated with these things.
Mm.
So he's saying that the way the endowment should operate is to create a pipeline to make it really easy for homeowners to build these things. And that would make it so that they're built all over the community, and it would create a new floor for an entry-level housing option. And then people can kind of grow out of that, but creating a new floor means that everything will kind of balance out a little bit lower.
I didn't even think of that.
Isn't that fascinating? I did not see that coming.
That is pretty cool.
And I actually misunderstood him. I was like, well, that's like the missing middle thing that Minneapolis tried to do. And he said, no, no, no. It's not missing middle. That's still aimed at families. That's still aimed at what I'm looking at, college students.
Oh.
I'm looking at people who are just striking out on their own.
Like me.
Right. Somebody like you. Don't you want to live in my basement? I mean, maybe the answer is yes. Maybe somebody like your parents, they would say, you know, my child has left town, but their friend still lives in town and needs a place to stay. So yeah, I'll rent this place that I have for $400, $500 to them.
Oh,
and then
okay.
They're removed from the housing market outside of that little context, and
yeah.
It makes it easier. Overall, it kind of just flattens out and mediates where things should be. And the thing that he said that was interesting to me is it's the only housing type that is completely scalable to the size of the community, because our community is largely built up of single family houses. So every single one of those could be an additional unit if we made it easy in a regulatory way to do that. That's not necessarily the case. I pulled up the code and I was looking at it. And for example, my house, which is in an it's either R3 or R5 district in downtown. My lot is too small for me to be allowed to have an ADU, and the regulations say 35% of your house, it can be no larger than that. My house is like 1,000 square feet, so that's a little small. That's like a 350 square foot place. So there would have to be some changes potentially to our code to make it a little bit easier. But he said the endowment could exert pressure to create a glide path for this kind of development.
I was going to say, how would the endowment do that?
Well, I think that they would have to be really creative about what they were trying to do. I think that they could come to architecture firms and say, can you create some plans that could be built automatically anywhere? And then they would have to go to the city and say, hey, we're working with this architecture firm. Can you come in the room with us and we can work together on this?
Hmm.
And I think that they might have to try and pressure city council or the county commission to modify their regulations, because right now there are a lot of things about our ADU code that make it harder to build them, at least in certain parts of the community. And that could change. Right now, they're kind of being pushed outside of downtown. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because there's a lot of parts of the city that don't really allow added density other than ADUs. So pushing more of the ADUs into those neighborhoods isn't such a bad thing.
Okay.
But I think there are regulations that could be tweaked to make it easier. And I mean, I'm thinking about how there are tons of neighborhoods in Wilmington with these absolutely massive front yards and very small backyards.
Yes.
You are not allowed to build an ADU in front of an existing house. It has to be behind and secondary to the other structure. So if they change that regulation, then each of those houses could have a little ADU in front of it and then have the big house be in the back. Like, and it's just because of the visual look from the street.
Yeah.
that's what has been the compelling reason behind saying no to a lot of these things. So if the vision was more about how can we make something that's adding more density be good enough or appealing enough that we can still say yes to this. And I think that the exterior conversion thing is also pretty interesting. I mean, in Oregon, there's a lot of basements. So basement conversions and garage conversions are really common. There's not a lot of basements in Wilmington because of the hurricanes and the soil.
Yes.
So exterior conversions where you put an extra door, you know, I could see that becoming a lot more common. But you have to make it so that the regulatory system that we have doesn't make that onerous for the people who are the homeowners. And there have to be financial systems in place to make it easy for them to do this. I pulled up, I was wondering about how much people are interested in doing this as a solution.
I was about to say, what's the cultural aspect of this?
Right, because not all homeowners are going to want to do this.
Yeah.
But in Sacramento, they did a poll of 1,000 homeowners, and it was like 37% of people were interested, which is really high to me, you know? That seems like a lot of people. Think about how many single-family homes are in Wilmington. If even a smaller number, if it was like 25 or 30%.
That's still a lot of homes.
That's still a lot of homes. We have a 16,000 unit gap expected by 2032. If that many, if a quarter of homeowners who were interested in doing this had it easy to do that, had the construction workers in place, they could just sort of show up at an office and somebody would walk them through it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an absolutely incredible addition to our housing stock without really changing the face of the community that much. I think it's a really fascinating idea. I do see flaws with it that I think we will probably get into when I do a panel about housing affordability and what the endowment can do in a couple weeks. I'm going to bring in McKay Siegel, who's a developer, Liz Carbone from Good Shepherd Center and the Housing Coalition, and Suzanne Rogers, who used to work for the city and now is with Cape Fear Collective. We're all going to talk about some of these options, and I am sure that we will hear criticisms of this idea.
Mm.
Liz Carbone, I know for sure, is going to point out that there's equity issues with creating housing that's a little bit harder to regulate in some ways.
Mm.
You know, you can't enforce equal housing access based on race if it's somebody's basement conversion or whatever.
Okay, that does make sense.
Societal discrimination could play a role in who's granted access to that. You know, like the college student might be able to get this a little bit more than somebody who was recently homeless.
Okay.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
But at the same time, this seems like an interesting option that's not very onerous for the community. Like, it won't be hard for people to see this happening in their neighborhoods. And it is everywhere. And it's a big adjustment that doesn't cost that much relatively. And I don't think that I don't think there's a single solution that hits on everything that we need.
Yeah.
This is like a option that could go pretty far. Maybe not the farthest that we need it to go, but I think it's a really interesting idea.
Well, I know we're looking forward to your panel to see what conclusions come out of that. Kelly, thank you for being on the show with me this week.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to the Cape Fear Rundown. Check out our show notes for relevant links and titles to the music we use this week. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, or just general feedback, feel free to get in touch. You can shoot me an email at cmojica, that's M-O-J-I-C-A, at whqr.org, or you can find me on X at CamiReports. I'd love to hear from you. I'm your host, Camille Mojica, and I'll see you next week.